This episode is brought to you by the American Homebrewers Association, host of Virtual Big Brew, a worldwide celebration of homebrewing that's happening this Saturday, May 2nd. Be counted in this year's record-breaking Virtual Big Brew event. Pledge to homebrew this May 2nd at homebrewersassociation.org. That's homebrewersassociation.org. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, April 30th, 2020. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Lars Marius Garshol of the blog Lars Blog and author of the new book Historical Brewing Techniques, The Lost Art of Farmhouse Brewing, will talk about his quest to illuminate and preserve traditional brewing techniques and his attempts at brewing Captinus, a beer that uses the oven to bring color and flavor to the mash. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. And if you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. And thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. On Monday, the general public got to see the latest episode of Basic Brewing Video, where Steve and I sampled my 15-minute Kvikking Pale Ale. We did it via video chat, which was a new experience. That went pretty good. We also shot another episode about my brown ale, which subscribers will get to see first next week, along with my recipe and a bonus video for upper-tier subscribers on Patreon. As usual, many thanks for those who are hanging with us during these tricky times. And speaking of those, you know, we and our family here are very fortunate at this point in time. We are able to hunker down at home, and because of my weird job, I'm able to continue working. And again, that's thanks to our supporters, you and sponsors, and Steve and everybody who contributes. Let's face it, you wouldn't be listening to this if it was just me yammering on for an hour. So our sons are able to be safe as well, and all of this is a luxury nowadays that we can't take for granted. All of this just to say that I appreciate everybody who has to get out and do the necessary things that keeps the rest of us going and keeps your family housed and fed. And as things start opening up across the country, more and more will be in that position. So just to say, I hope that we are all able to stay safe and healthy, and I hope that this situation resolves well soon. But you're listening to this to get your mind off of that stuff, right? Off of real life. to give you an update on what I've been brewing, I brewed a 5-gallon, 15-minute Hallertau Blanc cream ale this past Sunday. And, you know, I was really taken with that hop on the latest hop sampler, so I wanted to brew something that would show off its flavor. So I used Golden Promise with some flaked maize as the grain bill, only boiling for 15 minutes. I put an ounce or 28 grams of the Hallertau Blanc at the beginning of that short boil and another 2 ounces or 56 grams for a 5-minute hop stand at the end of the boil. And then after chilling, I pitched Imperial Julius, which I'm excited about as well. I'm planning to dry hop after fermentation with 2 more ounces of Hallertau Blanc in the fermenter before I keg it. The wort tasted really good going into the fermenter, so I have high hopes on this one, as I usually do. I brewed that beer, of course, with my electric brew-in-a-bag system from our friends and sponsors at High Gravity in Tulsa. Every now and then I'd look back to the Stone Ages when I used to brew with my propane setup. Mashing in my cylindrical cooler was a pain, and even when I moved to brew in a bag, I had to fuss with hitting strike water temperatures manually and worrying about how much temperature the mash was going to lose in the kettle over an hour. you know, wrapping it in blankets and towels, that never worked really. That never worked, even in summertime. Well, with my high-gravity electric system with the Warthog controller from highgravitybrew.com, all that is history. I just pour in my strike water, set the temperature with the Warthog controller, and walk away. And as I'm getting other stuff ready or eating a sandwich or whatever I'm doing, the water comes up to temperature and waits for me patiently. And then after I dough in, the mash stays at temperature, rock solid, no worries. And it's super easy to dial in the power to the heating element in the boil mode. So I can maintain the vigor of my boil exactly where I want it to be without worrying about the wind blowing all the heat away from a propane burner as it used to. I remember setting up little barriers around trying to get the barriers close enough to the burner to where they wouldn't catch on fire, but they would still block the wind. High Gravity has a wide variety of electric systems, both theirs and from other manufacturers as well, from 5 gallons to 2 barrels, single, double, and 3-vessel configurations. You can find them all at highgravitybrew.com. And if you use the code EBC75BB at highgravitybrew.com, you can save $75 off your electric brewing purchase. Take the pain out of propane. And always, as always, check out their ingredient kits and their awesome Build Your Own Beer page at family-owned and operated highgravitybrew.com. Okay, I'm very excited about this interview. Lars Marius Skarsholm has been very important in shining a light on traditional brewing techniques in Scandinavia and other parts of Europe. And in his new book, Historical Brewing Techniques, The Lost Art of Farmhouse Brewing, he continues that work. Lars Marius Skarsholm, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm really excited, and it's really a pleasure to talk to you because I've followed your work and I've been aware of your work for a long time. You are really, through your blog, Lars' blog, and through this book, Historical Brewing Techniques, The Lost Art of Farmhouse Brewing, you have really opened a window into these what have been, until recently, fairly obscure brewing techniques. And I feel like you are helping to preserve them for the future by documenting them and bringing, you know, attention to them. I think that you are having a hand in actually preserving a part of history. So congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Of course, the best way to preserve this is to have the brewers carry on actually brewing. And that's part of the motivation for writing about it, that if these people see that what they're doing is appreciated elsewhere, I hope that can encourage them to carry on and encourage other people in the same area to take up the tradition.
And you wrote in the book that you have come across farmhouse brewers who have either stopped brewing or have changed their ways of brewing because people like homebrew store owners and more modern brewers have talked to them and said, no, that's not the way to brew. You know, you're doing it wrong. And they've actually adopted to, you know, sort of more acceptable or a more accepted brewing technique. So that's a sad thing to hear.
Yeah, it's all done with the best of intentions, but yeah, there has been a good bit of that. And there's also a bit of, you know, young people in these areas that go studying or they read a modern homebrew book and they just take up the modern version instead, which is completely different. So this type of brewing is under threat. And that's kind of why I feel it's necessary to lift the status of it, as it were, to make people see how important it is.
And it's a little bit difficult, or it seems like it would be a little bit difficult because you are going into these areas and you're drinking these, and I hesitate to call them styles because I don't want to put boxes around these beers, but you're tasting these beers, and I would imagine it would be sort of difficult because they're so non—well, they are traditional. They're the definition of traditional, but they're non— they are out of the ordinary as far as what we consider, you know, normal beers. So it must be difficult for you to go into these situations and taste these beers for the first time and to know whether you're tasting a good example or not.
Yeah, that has been an issue. Although with some of them, you just taste it and it's like, okay, this is ridiculously good. This has to be a good example. It can't be anything else. Other times you're not quite sure. But it's you can always relate to it just as a normal person, right? And say, oh, I like this, or maybe this one was a little whatever, right? So in the kind of personal interaction, you can get by. It's okay.
Talk about how you got into this. How long have you been documenting these farmhouse beers? I almost said style again. But how long have you been documenting these farmhouse beers, and how did it capture attention in the first place?
Right. It's really like I say in the book, that I got this this book from my wife that mentioned this Lithuanian farmhouse brewer, and I decided to go to Lithuania and have a look, and was surprised to find that in the bars in Vilnius, you could actually buy this bizarre stuff over the counter. But at that point, the only thing I was really able to learn was that they have weird beers, and they taste unusual. And if you try asking, you know, what is this, or you got no answers at all. The people behind the bar counters had absolutely no idea. In fact, I even spoke to, I think it was last year, to a Lithuanian beer enthusiast who's also he works as a bartender, and he's very knowledgeable about beer. But he says that even he didn't know that some of these beers were farmhouse ales. He said of one of them that he thought it was just a weird Hefeweizen, when in reality it's a raw ale fermented with the family yeast and so on. So this stuff really was obscure. But eventually, it was in 2013 that I managed to get a tour of the Lithuanian farmhouse breweries. And that's when I started to kind of get behind the facade and get some real information. So I guess it's since then I've been documenting this stuff.
And you've been doing a lot of this in person, which I take it is important because and I might have used this analogy on the show before. My grandmother used to make these sugar cookies, and someone from her church wanted her recipe for the sugar cookies, and my grandmother couldn't give it to her because she didn't know. She just made the cookies. And so, you know, the person from the church had to go and watch my grandmother actually make the cookies and make notes and then try to sort of, you know, duplicate what my grandmother did, you know, because it had become, you know, I guess the recipe had been passed down from, you know, maybe her mother or something like that, and that she was doing this sort of by instinct rather than by thinking about it. So is that sort of what the impression that you get from a lot of these farmhouse brewers?
Yeah, it's a really good analogy, actually. It is exactly like that. It's, you know, it's the same with my grandma. If you asked her, you know, how much of this should I put in this dish, she would say, oh, the right amount, which of course she knew what it was without thinking about it, but she couldn't tell you. And it really is a lot like that with these brewers as well, because they've brewed the same beer all their lives, basically. And, you know, their ancestors also brewed not exactly the same beer, because technologically it's changed a bit over the last 100 years when they stopped making their own malts, for example. But still, They make only one beer, and they know exactly how to do it without necessarily being able to tell you. And there's also this tasting aspect, right? That when you read about one of these beers, you're in the same position as this person who wanted your grandmother's cookie, except she hasn't even tasted the cookie.
Mm.
And then you really don't know a whole lot about this beer. Let's put it that way. So I have literally many hundreds of descriptions of individual farmhouse ales where they're using some kind of heirloom land-raised grain that they malt with this method that nobody uses anymore, and then they brew, and you don't know the exact proportions, but you know the brewing process, and then they ferment with a yeast that's dead, and how is anybody going to know how this tastes?
Mm. And if you brew with a modern homebrewer nowadays, he or she will likely give you a lecture on each step. You know, we mash at this temperature in order to activate these enzymes, and and if you mash too high, it does this, and if you mash too low, it does this. And you know, we sort of know the science, or what we think is the science behind all of these steps of why we do the different things that we do. But I take it from reading your book that a lot of these brewers do these steps and they don't know why they're doing the steps, but there are things happening to the malt and to the beer that make it work. but they don't know why they're doing it. They're just doing it.
That's right. And I think also historically, they knew that when you mashed, you got the sugars out because you could taste that it got sweet. And today, they all know that the yeast then eats the sugar and makes alcohol and CO2. Historically, of course, they wouldn't know that last part in those terms. But beyond that, most of the chemistry is unknown to them. They don't know what happens. And of course, you don't need to know. You just need to know what to do. And for a lot of these brewers, they were maybe in the brew house with grandpa twice a year for 10 years before they brewed for the first time. They knew exactly what to do. So I think the main weakness that they have, in a sense, is that if you ask them to design a recipe for a different beer, that they would find that difficult. Mm. Of course, they'd be able to know, okay, I could use more malts, it will be stronger or less. And same with hops, it will be, hop beer and more bitter if I use more hops. But beyond that, they would have some difficulties, I think.
And it's hard to... Part of what I like about your book is that from brew house to brew house and from region to region, I mean, the scope of your travels and all the information, geographically is amazing. But then, from region to region, from farmhouse to farmhouse, the practices differ so much. And there are practices that we would not even think of doing here in the United States, or anybody who's read the standard homebrewing books. Can you talk about some of those practices and what are some of the most unusual practices that you're surprised work?
Well, the original surprise was that you could keep your own yeast, that you didn't have to boil the wort. Those were perhaps the first things that surprised me. And then later, I read about this practice of just putting cold water and malts into the kettle and then firing it up and doing the mash that way. And I thought, that's ridiculous. Until I thought about it and realized that, oh, this process is slow enough that you're going to get all the sugars. It's just a step mash with no steps, if you like. Mm-hmm. It's more fine grained. But and then, of course, I came across the oven baking, where you put the mash in the oven. But of course, I guess the craziest of all is the fermenting in the mash idea, which really seems like that's not. Is come on, guys, that can't work, can it? But apparently, it could, because it's reported from many different countries independently. So people must have done it. And of course, once you stop and you think about it. When you read about Mesopotamian beer, for example, these Mesopotamians were drinking the beer through straws to avoid the solids that were still in the beer. Well, I mean, if you're serving the beer with the malt still in it, it kind of follows logically that they must have fermented in the mash, right?
Sure.
So turns out it's not as unknown as we thought it was.
And you kind of debunk one of the stories that we tell each other about how beer evolved, and that's the magic stick theory of they stirred the beer or the wort with a stick that had yeast on it, and it fermented magically, and they didn't really know what yeast was, but. You say that it's sort of ridiculous that they wouldn't know what yeast was, because there's this sludge at the bottom that, you transfer from from beer to beer, or you transfer the beer on top of that sludge, and they're saving the yeast to use later on. So it's not like a magic stick. They knew that this magic stuff was doing the job. They didn't know that it was, you know, little multi or single cellular organisms that was doing the trick. But they knew what yeast was, and they knew how to preserve it and to protect it.
Yeah, they knew what it was in functional terms. So they knew what it did. They knew how you had to keep it. They knew that if it turned moldy, you had to throw it away. They knew that it wouldn't keep forever, that it could go bad or stop working, basically. And they had words for it, and they had words for the equipment to use with it and also for parts of the process. So there were fixed phrases for adding the yeast and this kind of thing. But I don't think the idea that they might not have known is inherently ridiculous. As Martin Thibault documented in Bolivia, there are South Americans who actually don't seem to know what yeast is. They just carefully don't clean their fermenters. It's not inherently impossible that they might not have known. It's just that we know from the documentation that they did, and we know that they had known for a very long time.
And now the Kvike is one of the family of yeasts, you know, that's coming out of these farmhouses, and you know, it's sort of setting the world on fire now. It's the big hot new thing that's been around for hundreds of years.
Yeah, that's really cool and also funny in one way that this old thing is now new and cool. But it's a real pleasure to me. I remember coming home from this trip to Western Norway in 2014 when I collected the first two Kvike cultures that I was able to get hold of. And I came home and was really excited about this and also a little sad that, like, there was this fantastic thing that nobody else knew about, well, outside of the brewing regions. So I'm really happy to see that that's changed and that these brewers are now getting some recognition for both for the yeast and for the tradition that they represent. So that's really good.
That's got to be gratifying that, you know, your work is having an impact.
Well, I mean, that is gratifying, but the important thing is keeping this tradition alive. That's really what's important. You know, these people or people in these areas have been brewing farmhouse ale for at least 3,000 years, probably longer, and to see, you know, that just die away and disappear would be horrible.
Well, let's get more specific because, you know, we can talk about, you know, generalities out of the book all day because it's such a deep subject. But let's talk about something that we haven't talked about on this show before, and that is beers made using an oven. And specifically, I looked at your blog today, and the latest post that you have on there is about your attempt to brew, and pardon my attempt at pronunciation, Kaptinis. So did I get close?
Yeah, you did. Yeah.
So talk about Kaptinis. Where is it from, and what is it? And, you know, talk about just give us an introduction at first.
Kaptinis is part of a larger family of beers that we can call oven-based beers. But we can start with Kaptinis on its own. It's a Lithuanian style of farmhouse ale where you first do a normal infusion mash for an hour or so. And then you take these huge traditional oven. You can think of it as a pizza oven, but it's not what it is. It just functions in a similar way, which you have heated and you bake the mash in there for 3 hours to caramelize it. And then you louter in the normal way, cool the wort, pitch the yeast, and you get this beer that's a dark, almost black beer, but it's not a porter, it's not a stout, it's not even like those beers. It's not like a Schweiz beer either. It's has this huge caramelly, toasty flavor. It's really, I don't know of any other way of making this beer than using that technique.
So they start with pale malt, and then by the end of it, they have a beer the color of the beer is more of a stout or a porter color. How would you describe it?
Yeah, it's black, opaque black. So it does look like a porter. Yeah, it's even got a slightly brownish head.
Where do the hops come in, or do they come in?
They do come in. In fact, they use more hops than you would have expected. This caramel flavor makes it, although it might not be very sweet, it makes it feel very sweet. So they use a good bit of hops. And what they do is, you'll notice I didn't describe any boiling of the wort here. What they do is they just take a kitchen pan with a couple of liters of water in it and boil the hops in there for 2 hours and then pour that in. This is called making hop tea, by the way.
The very first experiment that we did, a small batch experiment that we did back in 2005 on Basic Brewing Radio, and then the video version of that at the time, was an experiment in boiling hops in water alone and then adding that adding extract in later in that boiling process, because the assumption was that if you boil hops in water alone, you would get this grassy, astringent off flavor. And we didn't find that in our experiment. So what kind of character that do you get from making a hop tea in this instance? And are there any perceived off flavor or what we would consider off flavors from doing the hops in just the water alone?
No, I haven't noticed any off flavors from that at all. Most of the most farmhouse brewers don't really have appreciable hop flavor in their beer. You have to remember that all of the craft style hops basically started with Cascade, which, you know, didn't exist until the 1950s and wasn't on the market until the 70s. So they have used, for one thing, very different types of hops, but they've also generally not gotten a whole lot of aroma out of them. It's mostly been for preservation and for the balancing bitterness, basically. There is one Lithuanian brewer who uses a lot of hops. He uses his own hops from his own garden. And he gets a flavor that's kind of like, if you've tasted Dranke from Belgium, they have one that's called XX Bitter and a couple of more. But there's only this kind of noble hops character to the hops. It's not very fruity or anything like that.
And traditionally, one would assume that the hops that they would use in these farmhouse beers might be hops that they would find either, you know, growing wild or some heritage hops that have been passed down from generation to generation, right?
Yes. So a lot of people grew their own hops because it's really, really easy. It doesn't take a lot of work and you can just, you know, yeah, pick what you need, put it in a paper bag and let it dry. Some people did buy because eventually that became easier in some places, but they were all using fairly local hops until, I think maybe hops came on the market in the 50s or 60s or something like that. Most of these regions.
I did an interview with Mika Leitinen last year on Sati Brewing, and you know, we talked about the role that juniper has in, you know, in this region and brewing these beers. So with Keptinis, would juniper come into play as well?
I've heard people say that there are some brewers in Lithuania that have used juniper. I haven't seen any firsthand evidence myself. It's not impossible that somebody might use juniper in a Keptinis, but it would be rare.
But this specific beer is not about, it doesn't seem to be about, you know, sort of herbal character. It seems to be more just about the caramelization or the malt of the beer.
Yeah, and in general, that's the case for farmhouse ale all over, actually, that it's heavy on the malt flavor for several reasons, I guess. So one of them is that, what you're brewing from is your own grain. It's really, you have this farm, that's been the family farm, and this grain is kind of characteristic both of the farm and of your ability as a farmer. And then you malted it, so it's also characteristic of your ability as a malter. And then if you skimp on the malts, you're being a cheapskate to all your neighbors and friends and so on. So there were all kinds of reasons why you were expected to go heavy on the malts. And that kind of naturally put the emphasis in that direction.
And you talk a lot in your book about how brewing is a part of the community in these areas, and for some of these brewers, it's a status issue, not only of how much they share with their neighbors, but also how good the beer is as well. So there's a whole, it's woven into the culture.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you couldn't have a social gathering of any size or importance without serving beer. That was just unthinkable. A good example of that is the most famous painting of the Norwegian National Romanticism era, where the painters were really looking for characteristically Norwegian culture and nature and so on, is a peasant wedding procession on a fjord. So it's got this fjord landscape and all that, and the traditional costumes, and the bride wearing this kind of crown. And of course, there is a guy in the back of the boat serving beer, because the picture would be incomplete without it. It was a farmer's wedding with no beer would just be absurd.
So you took a stab at making Captinus on your own, and according to the blog post, you did it three times. Did you come close?
I came closer on the third attempt. So it turns out the issue is if you want a lot of caramelization, you need to go above 100 degrees Celsius, which is where water evaporates. And it's really hard to do that because it takes so much energy to evaporate out the water, and you get this tension between, on the one side, going too hard and burning the mash, and on the other side, not going far enough and not getting the water evaporated. So I'm still not sure exactly how to do it. I came closer on the third attempt, and I think these ovens consist of, they're really a massive pile of bricks, usually like 2 meters high, and something like 2, 3 meters long and at least 1 meter wide. So they're really big. They're in fact big enough that at some places, people use them as a sauna to bathe inside if they didn't have their own sauna. So you could fit the person in there. And the way they use them is, you light the fire in there and you heat up the brickwork. And then once the fire is burned down, you take out the embers and you put in the mash. So now, of course, the bricks underneath will be giving off a lot of heat to the bottom of these metal pans. And my electric oven doesn't do that. So using something like a pizza stone would probably help deliver more energy into the mash, but at the bottom without burning it so much.
And I guess we to build a picture in people's minds, you used these bread pans, these loaf pans. So imagine a loaf-shaped pan with a very thick mash in it. And when you say 100 degrees Celsius, you're talking about the internal temperature of those sort of loaves of thick mash.
Yeah.
And the oven itself, I think you said on the third that 190 degrees or Celsius, which is around 375 degrees Fahrenheit, with a fan, with a convection oven, seemed to be sort of closer to the sweet spot. But
yeah, that was the closest I was able to get. Yeah.
But these look delicious. I mean, I could just imagine this sweet malt, you know, this sweet, thick mash being baked and caramelized and, you know, even the burn parts, you know, look good to me.
Even the burned version, which was the second one where I went a lot higher, was actually quite good. So it's interesting that you can actually produce a number of different beers just by setting the temperature different. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't able to make it as good as the Lithuanian version. When there were some American tourists that dropped by when they were doing the last part of this brew, and they tasted the stuff from on top there, and I heard one of the guys saying to the other, "Oh, it tastes like honey. They're putting honey in the beer. That's really interesting." It's like, no, I watched them do it. There was no honey, but he was totally right about the flavor. It did taste as though there was honey in there.
Wow.
I wasn't able to do that. So I need to work some more on this.
And you sacrificed a set of pans at one point, unfortunately.
Well, yeah. I discovered that the higher the temperature, the more of the sugar you it goes through pyrolysis and it becomes this black, really, really hard material. And some of it was burned to these old style pans to the degree that I spent several hours cleaning one of them, and then I looked at the big one that was the worst, and I just, no way am I doing this. I just threw it away. So it was better with nonstick pans, but that stuff was like concrete. It was horrible.
So step one, get an understanding spouse.
yes, that's. She was very understanding about that. I mean, she understood what I was doing, why I was doing it. I was not just, you know, doing this for fun or because I was an idiot. It was just I was trying to figure out how to do it. And it was for the book, so.
It's for work, honey. It's for...
Well, I mean, she knew it was true, so that helps.
So the basic steps are make a very thick mash. To do your conversion first, then would it work better instead of the loaf pans if you were to spread the mash out in a thinner layer in the oven?
Maybe. I haven't tried, but I suspect if you do that, you find that you run into capacity issues, that you can't mash the same volume of malt, probably. Mm. But it's worth trying, and you might try to combine that. Have some bread pans and then some flat ones. Because this isn't an absolute thing, right? It's not like you either get the right amount of caramelization or you can't make it.
And if you don't get the quote-unquote proper amount, you still have a beer that probably tastes good. It's just different from what you anticipated.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So I made three interesting beers, all of them quite good. And none of them quite what I tried to do, but there wasn't like a failure. And that's kind of reassuring, right? For anyone who wants to try that, if you, it should be pretty good anyway.
So while the mash is in the oven, you boil some hops, in some water to make a hop tea to get your bitterness. And then how does it work? How do you make the liquid out of these, you know, sort of loaves of mash?
Well, you take out the pans and you use something hard that doesn't scrape the pan. So I used like a wooden fork, a large one, and you have to kind of dig the stuff out of the pans and you just put it in the mash tun. Then you can, you know, dump the hop tea in there and then add the hot water like you normally do for lautering. Now you have to replace a lot of the water that evaporated, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Just leave it for a little while. So it liquefies and gets to settle, and then you start lautering in the normal way.
And you just run that off into a fermenter and let it cool, and then pitch your yeast, essentially combine it with the hop tea,
that was my original plan. And then I look at my plastic fermenter and I think, do I want to put 75 degree liquid into this? Maybe not. So I put the cooling step in between there. But yes.
It sounds easy. in theory.
Well, I mean, yeah, but that is kind of farmhouse brewing in a nutshell. This is brewing without, you know, millimeter precision. Like, just get it roughly right, and it'll be fine.
It's beer. Beer is fairly forgiving.
Yes. yeah, it is. It is. One of these farmhouse brewers I've gotten to know has he's gone to a few farmhouse ale festivals where he meets modern brewers, and that's been a cultural clash for him. So he now talks about millimeter brewers. So that means modern brewers, people who care about getting the numbers exactly right, and they know how strong their beer is and all these weird things. So you can make good beer without all this precision. Yeah, totally.
And that's another challenge that you faced in doing this research, you know, getting the numbers in these, you know, to talk about how strong these beers are. And the brewers may not know, you know, what the original gravity and the final gravity and the alcohol content, you know, it's just beer and it tastes good. And it had this effect on me, this batch, and this effect on me, that batch. And
yeah, my favorite is the guy from, this was from Ål in Eastern Norway, who said that, well, I know my beer is stronger than normal Pilsner from the shop. It's like, how? And I wondered, how do you know that? Well, there was this guy who had been tested by the police 1 hour after drinking one of his beers, and they measured the his alcohol content in his blood. And so the day after, he did it again with the Pilsner, and he had a lower score. So, so he knew the beer was stronger than 4.5 then.
Sounds like his friend needs to search out some counseling somewhere.
Well, I mean, the day after he did it, he got measured deliberately.
Oh, I see. I thought if he's got a daily appointment with the police, I think there's a problem.
Yeah, I totally agree. That was I could have been clearer then. Yep.
And talking about the strength, what are the numbers on the Captinus or what you were brewing, the starting gravity and the final gravity and then the alcohol level?
I don't remember, to be honest. if I remember correctly, it's like 6% maybe. I would think that in general, the stronger you make it, the more you get of this caramel flavor. But I also imagine at some point it perhaps gets to be a bit much. Mm. So 6% is probably a good idea.
Yeah, it seems like there would be an opportunity for a lot of residual sugar to be in there. And without, you know, the balancing of a lot of bitterness, you know, from hops, it might get a little bit too sweet.
Yeah. Well, this would also... in theory, you should have had very high conversion because you first have a good infusion mash, and then you get it like a step mash, step less mash. You're preparing the pans, then you're putting them in, then they get heated back up. So you get like another hour of many different temperatures there before the enzymes get denatured. But then, of course... the stuff this caramelizes and isn't going to be fermented. And then how much of that is going to taste sweet? It's really difficult to actually judge these things. Hmm. So in the end, you just have to try it. There's no other way.
Talking about the mashing happening in the oven, you talk about other oven beers in another region where that is the practice. I mean, they prepare a container, put the mash in that, and then just stick that in the oven, right?
Yeah, this is the broader picture, and the key idea here is to be aware that historically, large metal kettles were really, really expensive to the point that most people just couldn't afford them at all. So, for a long time in farmhouse brewing, the biggest technical challenge was, how do you heat the mash? And this is, of course, where stone brewing came from, where you just used the stones to do that in a wooden vessel. Mm-hmm. But then the Russians developed this, or we think it was the Russians, developed this large oven that I was talking about. which exists in Russia and Eastern Finland and the Baltics and many other places. It exists way actually into Asia as well. And they realized that, hey, we can just use the oven to heat the mash, which must have been a fairly natural idea because people were also using this oven for cooking. So most traditional Russian food was cooked in the oven. So the starting point, I think, was that you use the oven to do the mashing. And a lot of different variants came out of that. So what you see in the book that I documented was people using a ceramic vessel in Russia called a korchaga. It's really simple. You put straw in the bottom, and there's a hole right below the straw with a plug. You put cold water in, you put the malts in, and just seal the thing properly, put it in the oven, and of course the temperature will go up, and it spends like 12 hours in there. Wow. So if you've done this right, then it will mash in there, and then afterwards you just take out the plug, and here comes your wort. That's really, but I think probably there was another method before that where some Lithuanians actually don't use any containers at all, and they just form these bread-like shapes of wet mash and then put that in the oven. And this was also done in Eastern Finland and in Estonia, probably also in Latvia, probably also in parts of Russia. So there's this giant territory here of different oven-based styles that's not well documented.
So the theory is that even if you don't do a mash rest outside the oven, after you put it in the oven, the contents of those containers or maybe that loaf heats up slowly enough through those sacrification rest temperatures so that there is conversion that happens, and the sugars actually do get taken out of the mash, and so the process still works.
Yeah, we know that it does because I did this together with Dmitry Shezlov in Russia, and we broke tradition and took his korchaga out of the oven with the mash in it after an hour and measured the temperature, and it was 80 degrees Celsius. So he hadn't gotten a full hour of normal mashing, but certainly something close to it.
Yeah,
and I also tasted his beer, and yeah, totally, he did get conversion. He did get a decent amount of alcohol, and this was his only mash. He didn't do anything else.
So if it's in there for 12 hours, I would assume that eventually it goes through a boiling process as well.
We don't know. I think maybe sometimes it does, and maybe it doesn't. We were trying to judge this with Dmitry's version when we were there. Some liquid had run over, but it didn't look like it had boiled. But it's hard to tell. What I really need is a USB, you know, or a Wi-Fi temperature sensor that I can put in there and go through the whole process. Then we should be able to get a temperature curve and all that stuff. But I don't have it. But it might boil, yeah.
But then you're taking away from a little bit of the magic there. You're pulling the curtain away from the Wizard of Oz there.
yeah, but I want to know. That's kind of what's driving all of this. I want to know.
So on these beers, is a hop tea employed as well? Or what's the process after the container is brought out of the oven?
Well, I mean, now we're talking about a region stretching from basically from the Baltic Sea, roughly, to the Ural Mountains. And knows how far north and south it goes. But this is like a gigantic area. So there's anything that you can imagine people will have done, basically. But in the case of Dmitry, what he did was he actually boiled the wort with hops in it.
Ah.
So that was disappointingly normal in one way, but there will have been people, I'm sure there will have been people just putting the hops in the container in the oven with the mash, and there will have been people boiling, there has been people boiling hop tea. The Estonians, I remember now, boiled hop tea and added, not all of them, but many of them.
And what's the temperature of the oven in this instance? Is it as hot as with the Captinus?
I think not. It didn't seem to be. So I didn't measure, but I don't think it was as hot.
I feel an experiment coming on.
Yeah. Yeah. The trouble is, to do this one right, you really do need this kind of, as the Russians call it, a pechka oven. And those are, I mean, there's no room in this house for one, that's for sure. Although I am told that in a region where you have stable temperatures, so in winter when it's cold, it's really cold and it's predictably cold, then it's the best way to heat your house because you heat it like twice a week. Mm. And it keeps a really even temperature all day, all night throughout the entire house.
Wow.
But here in Norway, that would not be a good idea because, you know, you would heat it in January when it's really cold, and then the weather changes and it's suddenly it's 1 outside and you have to open all the windows.
So those bricks maintain, or the structure of the oven really retains the heat.
Yeah, that's a large part of the reason for using it because, you know, you conserve on the amount of firewood that you need. So it's very cleverly constructed with these passages inside the oven that leave the heat in the brickwork, but also allow a good flow of air through the oven. So apparently the profession of constructing such an oven was highly respected in Russia. Mm. That was a major school.
Well, Lars Marius, I have a feeling that we have just barely scratched the surface, of your knowledge and even of this book, and maybe that's a good thing. Maybe if you're open to it, we can have you on again in the future, and we can pick another topic and explore some more. I've had a lot of fun,
sure.
and it's an honor to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Thanks again to Lars Marius. If you haven't seen it, check out Lars' blog. Just do a Google search for Lars' blog, LARSBLOG, and pick up a copy of Historical Brewing Techniques, The Lost Art of Farmhouse Brewing. I really enjoyed reading that book, and I've got some ideas on how to do a small batch pseudo Captinus. So stay tuned. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form at basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. As usual, special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. That's all until next time. Till then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our websites provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. In the meantime, stay well and stay tuned. So long.